Okay, this is continuing with Gordon Stanley on 13 June 74.
So many events and so many things going on, you know, it's difficult. I'll have to sit down sometime and try to sort this out, exactly what event triggered this. But it must have been, see, there was a small Mills Cross built. The first clash was over the small Mills Cross.
This is a prototype, just to demonstrate that it could work.
The small Mills Cross at Potts Hill, and then the scene of Fromberg, that was the first decision. The second decision now is the larger Mills Cross, the Fleurs instrument, and again the interferometer which John was proposing. Well, Joe was sort of vacillating because I think he had made his decision.
What was the interferometer precisely? It was a couple of cylindrical
parabolas right cylindrical parabolas on rails, the basic concept of this thing. And Joe had been vacillating somewhat. He might not have been vacillating, he might have made his own decision in his own mind about what to do, but it was pretty clear to me that of course he was going to go ahead with the larger Mills Cross, and again I felt that this was the right decision, because as I mentioned a little way back in our conversation when I came here, I felt that we were attempting a technical problem which was not easily solved.
Mm.
So John came into my office. I had an office just on the lower ground floor of radio physics one day, and said, "I'm going to force a showdown on this. I'm going up to see Joe, and it's either this or something else." So all I know, he only spent about 15 minutes, and I know he went into Joe's office. I don't know what words we used. Then they both went into Taffy's office, and John came down and said, "I'm out of radio astronomy."
This was when?
Now we're getting up to the period of 1953-54. And we'd been working together quite a long time, and my own relationship with John was not that good at that time. Because I must say that I've taken the opposite technical viewpoint on,
yeah, as you mentioned,
on
already,
several,
yeah,
of the, you know, several of the developments there. So I went then just by myself and kept going with the 90-foot parabola and worked with Dick McGee a little bit, and with Bob Price and Jeterine. And Joe was sort of worried that I wasn't making best use of my talents not too long before I came here, and asked me to, at that time there was the idea kicking around that large clusters should contain a large amount of neutral hydrogen. I think it resulted from a paper written by somebody at Berkeley, and it was the basis, you might remember, of Dave Heesham's thesis.
That's right, yeah, I looked at it.
And Joe asked me to check into that, and actually I did, and never published, and found that there was really nothing there as far as I could see. The reason I didn't do anything about it was that I was already on one negative paper, and I was sort of vacillating about the deuterium because I got nothing, and then the Russians made it for me by publishing a positive result, which I could shoot them down on, which is an argument for publishing every negative result you get.
But before you go on further, it seems like you skipped over a certain period of time as to what you were doing astronomically anyway. Did you work with a 90-foot hole in the ground?
Yes.
What did you do with it?
Well, the deuterium was done with that. The other project done with that was not really very exciting. The idea was, of course, that the idea would be basically a good one now. And it's surprising to me that the Australians don't propose something like this. There they have the galactic center sitting straight overhead. Why not get into microwave spectroscopy with an instrument of this sort, which is the ideal, not the ideal, yeah, but it's a damn good way of doing millimeter wave astronomy. Yeah, we've got a very stable background. They've got some very stable locations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyhow, that was the basic idea. I mean, the galactic center had not been mapped very well, and So there was a sort of an unexciting, besides the deuterium stuff, there was a rather unexciting map of the galactic center region of 400 megahertz. Nothing terribly exciting. So there was a period of 2 years there, I think, which was sort of rather dull. That was bringing me up to about 54. And that was when Joe suggested that I'd say it's more like a year. I'd say it's a period between about 53 and 54, which sort of things struggled along, and it was obvious that I had to make a decision myself to get out of Dover Heights. And I've always been a very independent person. I mean, being a director of an organization is not the sort of job that ever appealed to me. I see what happens to directors. They get torn up too easily.
I get the impression from everyone I've talked to, including the people themselves, that almost everyone that early CSIRO group is sort of an independent-minded.
Oh, sure. That was one of the disasters. And I probably was the most independent-minded of any of them.
Probably all of them would claim that. Independently.
Well, yeah, but I don't mean scientifically. It's just my nature. Right?
Well, that's
I've
what I mean.
Never participated in sort of anything myself. It's somewhat the accepted Australian characteristic, I suppose. But I would, as far as their research was concerned, a lot of them were a hell of a lot more independent than I was. It's just in my own personality, which is
But it must have taken a lot of skill by Posse to hold all these horses together.
Well, that's where it came apart, finally, because although Prosy's talent, I think, was in dealing with young people, and I've seen myself in running, well, I knew what I was getting into in trying to run a group like this. When the people are young, that sort of technique works very well. When they become adults, in effect, or at least scientific adults, then it doesn't work so well. You let people run loose. And the difficulty was that they got into each other's hair. They started to sort of, there were lots of little factional disputes, you're doing my work and things like that. And they never really came to the surface. When the guys were weak enough, it didn't matter. But when the guys started to feel around it. See, John and I suppose that was an interesting thing too. It wasn't that we were paranoid, but one of the things we felt was a great deal of jealousy on the other people in the group, because here we were for quite a long time. There was a period of 4 or 5 years there where we were the only ones who were getting anything, who had anything in this new game. I mean, the Sun had become rather dull. I mean, so you published another paper on a polarized sunspot or something like that, and it was very dull stuff. And the people who sort of had the background in physics, like Steve Smird, were somewhat in disrepute. I mean, that wasn't sort of the accepted thing to do in the lab, which was essentially a practical place. And the talent of Paul Weil, who was probably the greatest of the radio astronomers, that radio physics wasn't obvious until a little later.
You're talking about the period of the late 40s now.
Well, yes, the late 40s, early 50s. I'm going on a little bit. I'd say the peak of our success at radio physics was about, I would say, up to 51. And then after 51, well, that was 51 was just about the Ewan Purcell H1 discovery.
Right.
At that time, Frank Kerr was in Harvard working with those people. And then I was in on that, too. That was another thing which I'd forgotten I'd done. Prosy constructed this massive project, you know, which was to sort of look at H1 in Sydney. And although I didn't appear on the paper, I mean, a number of people contributed technical skills. The thing was built in bits, little building blocks. A paper was written, Christensen and who else, I forget.
Christensen and Hyman.
Yeah, Christensen, Hyman, and a few other people. But it was sort of a big, massive effort to sort of, you know, do things down there. And at that stage, other people started to get into the act, and other people started to build up their reputations.
Like Paul Weil.
So some of the concentrated jealousy, which I think we felt in those days, I always feel scientists are like little boys, and I still work on that theory of disappearing. But then, as you got a lot of stronger individuals, Christensen, Bracewell came back rather late, of course, Frank Kerr, and so on, Paul Weil. Then Prosy became a little bit worse at handling things. I mean, Prosy could never really doubt a man's motives. He was such a beautiful guy himself, he couldn't see that somebody was stabbing him in the back. The reasons I came here were not anything really very significantly to do with radio physics. They were purely personal, strangely, but one of the things I didn't like at the time was that I know I could see what was going to happen at radio physics. Taffy was a much, much stronger man than Joe Causey. There was no question about that. I mean, The thing I always found about Taffy, and I knew him well, I think I understood Taffy better than any other guy at the lab, was that you would always underestimate how ruthless he was.
Mm-hmm.
He was the ideal hatchet man, the ideal administrator like
that.
Soft-spoken,
yeah.
Yeah, and when the bigger controversy started about the next step, the bigger Mills Cross and the array, there's very little doubt in my mind that Taffy had decided that you eliminate people sort of one by one. And in effect, in some cases he was lucky, and in other cases he planned it, but in effect he eliminated. This happened after I got here, of course, finally, but I could see it coming.
Yeah.
Each step of the way.
Just tell me for my information, I don't know quite what happened. What did happen to John Bolton?
He went into rainmaking.
After the mid-50s, I see.
He went into rainmaking about 53, I think that was. That was that day I talked about. He came back, he said, I'm out of radio astronomy, I'm in rainmaking. I'm in rain physics.
And he never did any more...
He never did any more radio astronomy. And he didn't do anything until... And the way he came here was that Taffy had come to the radiation lab at MIT during the war on the magnetron mission and became a very close friend of Lee Bridge. And so when Lee said there was some suggestion of setting up radio astronomy at Caltech, could he recommend somebody, he recommended John.
I see.
Because John at that time was then supporting Taffy in his big dish thing. So.
Okay, so I guess that's up to the point now of you coming to the U.S. in 55.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty rough coverage of what happened
okay.
in 55.
Now, you just said how this got started at Caltech, basically, and I suppose, or how, now, so Bolton was invited to what, to set it up, or?
Well, I've got all the documents back there. You know, people have asked me this question a number of times, so it's, in this case, I've got documents, so I can almost
yeah.
tell you, and even with the documents, it's not quite clear how it started. It is clear that a very large fraction of the prominent astronomers at Caltech were against setting up radio astronomy. I don't specifically want to name names, but it's not that I want to withhold, but it's very difficult for me to identify
no.
which ones. But I think the thing was really set up partly because of an excitement between Bob Barker, who was then the chairman of the physics department, and Lee DeBridge. I'm pretty sure that Santa Barbara Street was against it, because I know, talking to Ike Bowen later, he sort of didn't want any part of radio astronomy. It was sort of an illegitimate science.
Well, this was just the general conservatism of the
sure.
of all optical astronomers at that time. And
well, it was, I can tell you some, you know, I went to, going way back now to Australia, one of the things I did was to set up a mattress array at Palomar at one stage with C.W. Allen.
Not at Palomar, at Siding Springs.
No, it was Mount Stromlo.
Stromlo.
Excuse me. Mount Stromlo.
Yeah.
Which C.W. Allen did his 200 megahertz map of the galaxy on. And I remember going and spending time up there with, we saw a little bit of Woolley and D.F. Martin and Gottlieb, besides Allen. And I remember Woolley was sort of particularly disparaging about radio astronomy, that he was quite adamant that it was sort of a lot of nonsense, that radio sources just didn't exist at all. Extragalactic radio sources, anyhow, he was prepared to accept free emission.
He actually did write a paper a little bit about free emission, you know, in 48.
Yeah,
monthly
yeah. He was quite happy about that part of it. As far as the extragalactic sources, that was a lot of nonsense. We were just seeing nothing at all.
Yeah.
Martin was somewhat more charitable. So the astronomers here were in quite good company, and Jesse Greenstein tells the story against himself of going to see one of Groke Reavis' early installations. He was sent as a
right.
some committee of the AAS, I think, to report on whether Reba had anything, and came back and sort of said there was nothing there, it was all cars passing the antenna or something like that. Anyhow, so there was sort of it was not unexpected that there was some opposition. Anyhow,
along the same line, you did work, though, on the identification of these sources with Bada and or Minkowski, didn't you? I mean,
yes,
these are obviously two who did have a different point of view.
Bada and Minkowski, I didn't say everyone, I said there were other people who had a different point of view, and Minkowski was one of the people who were quite excited about it.
Can you just say a little bit about what that relationship was? Was it just a matter of you just wrote them a letter and tried to get them interested, or how did that work?
No, I think Minkowski... Of course, Minkowski's still alive, and you can ask him.
Well, I just talked to him last week.
Yeah.
I want to get your side of it.
I really couldn't add much light on that, quite frankly. I think Minkowski just became excited on his own bat, and I think actually it was more by talking to the English radio astronomers. I think people like Graham Smith would be my guess, rather than talking to us. Of course, once we got here, that was a different matter.
Right, then you had obviously better contact, yeah.
Yeah. Bader, of course, was a very exciting guy, and he was one of the kindest of people, too. But it seemed to me that Bader's interest was more general. It was Minkowski who was the one who was always specifically interested in what was going on in radio astronomy.
You have any idea as to what it was in the personalities of these two great astronomers that enabled them to see the value of radio astronomy, whereas a lot of other great optical astronomers didn't? I've been trying to get a handle on this, and I don't seem to be able to, as to what distinguishes them and Bach as another.
Well, I think the thing, I often think, looking at Joe Pauzy, there's a difference in personalities, which is the easiest way to get at it. Joe Pauzy, I said, had sort of a childlike simplicity about him, a childlike curiosity. He sort of was not a sophisticated man in the least. And I find this is a talent which a lot of people who are truly great have in common, that the man who's not great tends to think more in terms of the status quo a lot of the time. If you can retain your feeling that science is not a business, that I always, when I mentioned about the joy I got out of the early part of it, and the thing I always feel about fundamental research, what I try to stress is that it's not a business, it's a game. I know many people have said this, I'm not saying anything original, but if you're not having a hell of a lot of fun doing it, get out of it, stop it.
Yeah.
And Minkowski was sort of like that. There was something unsophisticated about Minkowski too, a sort of rather childlike simplicity and a willingness. If he was a businessman, you'd call him a sucker or something like that.
Right.
And Joe, you would have called a sucker too, but I think that's actually an important character.
But this then gives an openness to...
Gives an openness to their approach.
New ideas, yeah. Okay, that's interesting.
Bader, though, was the exception that proves the rule, because he was somewhat of a more sophisticated personality. I felt anyhow myself.
Yeah. Okay, I detracted. You were talking about someone named Parker or Barker.
Barker, Bob Barker. Yeah. Bob Barker was chairman of the division. Bob Barker had already got a commitment from the Office of Naval Research that they would support an effort in radio astronomy, but the amount of commitment was sort of very low. I mean, he just made some general remarks. And I think John had written him a letter about building a small parabola and sticking up on the roof or something like that, or a small instrument. And the amount, did I mention it, 40K, I think, or something like that, something less, as a matter of fact, the Navy promised to commit. And Barker was actually the first principal investigator. I mean, he was on the contract as his principal investigator.
And this is what time, what year is this?
We're talking 1954. In fact, Barker remained the principal investigator until within about 6 months, I think, of when John left to go back to Australia. It was one of the sort of bones of contention between he and John. I think Barker was a very conservative man and didn't believe in letting things get too wild. He was a bit scared of these wild-eyed guys who might spend a couple of $1 million and account for it. I think that was Barker's way of worrying.
But he never published anything, Barker did.
No, Barker was never. He was purely an administrator. And to my mind, one of the finest scientific administrators I've ever seen. I think I learned a lot more from Barker than I had from any other man as far as administration and research goes. Anyhow, when John came, he immediately brought up the two-element interferometer. He'd spoken to me. In fact, as I said, our relationship wasn't that good. And I came almost purely for personal reasons. I mean, I said I'm independent, but independent in a different way. I mean, I built myself a house. I've been married a few years and built a house in a particularly lovely part of Sydney, as a matter of fact. And I had plans of going into something else, as a matter of fact. And by some curious sort of thing, a big contractor had built a house nearby us and had so disgusted me with what he'd done that John came and spoke to me and said, what about coming to the States for a year? I sort of was surprised even to see John, as a matter of fact, because her relationship with that deteriorated, as a matter of fact, by that time. It wasn't the attraction of coming to the States, it was just the attraction of getting away and thinking about something and then coming back and doing something else that made me go. So
he was.
Jane talked to me at that time about the two-element idea and said, what could I think of it? And I said, yeah, it sounds a good idea. And John is a man who gets... who lives on two levels. He can become very euphoric when he's on top. I think John's personality, I think a lot of people have noticed this with John, he can become a very arrogant sort of a person when he's on top of the world. When he's down, you know, he again is a very beautiful guy. He's a very vulnerable sort of a person. I know a lot of people, but it's really, when I first knew John, I found him basically a very shy person. And he has, I think, the arrogance of a shy man. And I don't think a lot of people would see that in him now, but that's where I think it came from. I think if you talk to Menzel, you'd probably get this side of John. I think he was always impressed by the fact that John was telling him to do things he had no right to tell him, that he was a very arrogant person. Anyhow, we talked about the inner problem, so that was a guy. John was on top and thought, well, I can get millions of dollars. And he really hadn't talked to anybody here. He had just this letter of commitment. It was a wonderful release from him. He really wanted to get out of radio making and back into radio astronomy. Right.
So this was really the same idea that he'd been trying to get.
Right.
Going at CSIRO.
Right. Right. It was the same idea again. So when he got there, got here, he talked to Barker. This stuff is in the files there, as fact. And he wanted more than the 40K, he wanted 90K, see, and that was the basis. He was writing backwards and forwards to me at that time, various letters saying, well, what will we do to get going? So, okay, let's build another 30-foot parabola. I built a little one. I didn't tell you about that. We did quite a lot of work on that, too, at 200 megahertz. There's a lot of stuff in that early identification work that's almost out of memory now. And so I said, I'll design another one of those myself when I get there, and that will be a good start, and we got 90K for that. And then John started to hatch the plot about the larger instrument. And of course that really took them aback because it's starting to look like $1 million. And I mean, this was way beyond what anybody had thought was involved in the project.
So he came in 54, you came in 55.
No, he came actually in 55 and I came a few months later. A lot of this had been going on here with Barker and in correspondence.
Before.
So I came in June of 55, and he was here in January, February.
And so your first thing was to work on a 30-foot.
Yes, that was that some work came out of that. That was the instrument which is out there now, as a matter of fact, sitting out in the pasture, and was erected at Palomar for a while.
Right. When I heard about this instrument, when did it actually go up in Palomar?
I had that going. It was one of the quickest things ever. I think I had it going early in 1956.
And what did it do up there?
It just did a 21 centimeter survey. It really, there's some papers published on it. There's one published in all things, the ASP.
I see. By whom?
Myself and John, a couple of collection of 21 centimeter profiles.
Huh, I haven't seen that paper.
I'm pretty sure it exists, and at that time Tom Matthews had also come along, and we'd done half of it, and he was supposed to do another half of it. And there were a lot of things going on in parallel. And John, before I got here, had hatched actually the 90-foot plot and was looking for an observatory site, and he found one down near Ojai. And just as I arrived, he'd received word from the Navy that they wanted this Ojai site for a classified purpose. Actually, it was one of the early Nike stations, and mm-hmm. I believe it's still there. And so we had to start over again in a search for a site. And he was about to go overseas, and so I undertook the search myself with Well, I did some of it with John. We went south, actually. We'd sort of set a specification of 100 miles radius from Pasadena, which, and beyond that, the operation of the observatory became very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd gone south with John. We went down south to the Mexican border, and we never really found anything suitable down there. And he'd searched up the coastline, so we knew that Santa Barbara was the limit of our 100-mile radius, and he'd looked at Ojai, and there was nothing there. So we started to go inland, and we covered most of the inland valleys up in the Saugus region and around there, and didn't get any luck. So he had to go at that time, so I started to go with a man called Larrabee, who was an engineer both here and later at Hat Creek, as a matter of fact. And we extended we went a bit beyond the 100-mile range, actually. It's about 130 miles to Inyukun. And there was a reasonably flat area there, and then we found there was a missile testing station there, so that was impossible, and I was about to give up in disgust, and the man Larrabee said, well, this was August, and that's what I was referring to last night.
Oh, yeah.
He said, we've got another 100 miles to go, and he said, very beautiful place. He said, I spent my honeymoon with my second wife up there, and I'd just like to go up there for kicks. So we kept on driving, and we stopped almost right. There was no road out here, and we rode along the dirt, and I had testing equipment. And I said, we might as well test here. I said, this is almost perfect. And that really was it. When John came back in September, he came up here back in one day and agreed, and that was the start of the whole thing.
Hmm. What year was this now?
We're talking 55, that's the first year again.
This is still 55, I see.
Yeah, but we picked the site, but we still didn't have any money from for the telescopes, and we were going ahead with the construction of the 30-foot at Palomar. It wasn't clear that we would go ahead with this. I mean, we one of the reasons for Palomar was that we thought, well, maybe if we got an operating telescope, we might be able to get over some of the interference problems, and we were pretty disillusioned after operating for about a year up at Palomar. There was a Hamad Valley down there and places like that which looked as if, well, if we could put up with a reasonable amount of interference, maybe we could work in there.
That didn't work out.
No.
So what was the next actual piece of equipment that got built? I assume it was one of the 90-foot.
Well, the first test, no, the first instrument. The next instrument that built was an array, a 26 megahertz array, which was built just out here in the field. And this was to be a test instrument, and it had rather spectacular results. It was just that we were not interested in doing low frequency work. We didn't go ahead with it. And there is another paper in ASP on that, which is a measurement of the coronal diameter of the sun at 26 megahertz. It was a very pretty result. In fact, if I had to feel a little bit upset about something, I think it's something which has been lost in the literature, because I think it was rediscovered by Bill Erickson some years later. John actually had, there was one decision John made too, and it's funny talking about the ASP, he said, okay, let's sort of have a tame journal and we'll try and build up the reputation of a low-quality journal and publish in the ASP.
I see.
So the early publications were fairly low quality, but they were published. And there was also another paper on Centaurus, I think, was published there too.
And this, you say, is a test array. That was just to sample the interference, you mean?
Or? I'm not quite clear why I built the damn thing. I thought, gee, I'd like to build one of those dipole arrays, long wavelength dipole arrays, and it was partly to sample the interference, and I was quite surprised what clean records they got. And we looked at a number of sources, but didn't publish anything else except this solar diameter array thing.
That's interesting. I'll have to look those up. What was the next step, instrumentally or
well, by this time, by this time we'd got the money. Or if you ever want, actually, it gets a bit dull here getting the actual documentation together and telling you exactly how things went together. But the money was coming through for the 90 foots, and so the design of the 90 foots had started. Although the design had started without a firm idea of how much the darn things were going to cost. That sort of came later when the project finally got up to about $800,000, and everybody was getting quite shocked at what was involved.
Why was it so much more? I mean, the rail track, of course, adds to the cost.
Well, nobody had any real idea of what it cost to build a thing like this, you know. I mean, these were fairly novel at that time. And
Well, but there were
the 90 foot, the whole brash of 90 foot round.
In fact,
it was a measure of John's brashness, I think, at that stage, because I think it was the source of a little irritation between he and Fred, because Fred was quite a power in the land, and you can check this with Fred at that time, because Fred was trying to buy one of the conventional, what's the name?
Kennedy. Or Blownox.
Yeah, the Blownox dishes at that time, and had an actually firm price because they knew quite well, and John was going around saying he could build one for about half the price. Now, it was partly John, here was John coming into a new country and trying to get into things, and I suppose the reason for the discrepancy was in discussions between he and Bruce Rule. Bruce would dearly love to design a telescope, John would dearly love to build something and sell it as being novel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there was a little bit of euphoria went on there. It was just that they didn't really get into it solidly, and when all the chips were down, it really cost just as much as the Blownox.
Right. So there was this period of development when there was not much scientific results coming.
No, only this Mapress array. And see, even up to the time that John left, you know, to go back to Australia, only been about half a dozen papers come out of the whole.
When was that? They left?
1960.
And why was that, may I ask?
Well, there was a little friction between he and Barker, but I think the real thing. Well, I told John he was a fool to go back, but the real thing was that Taffy offered him the job at the directorship of the 210. The 210 was well on. Taffy had eliminated all his enemies, and he was in a position he really didn't have anybody amongst the senior people who really wanted to take on the business of running it. Paul was the only man left unslain amongst them, and Paul didn't want to get involved in that because he had his own project and his group was very happy.
Right, so
and John, I think, went back because he felt, I said to him, you're so foolish. I said, with the whole thing is, you've got it made here if you want to stay. You've got no particular tie to Australia. The whole thing can build up into something which is much bigger than what is going on at Parkes. He never said this to me, but I think it was just a question that he felt better still about Joe, and he was the opportunity to be sort of one up on Joe by going back and taking over the directorship of the Parkes operation. So he went, and it left us in a pretty tough position.
As I say,
I've always, personally, I've sort of withdrawn. I mean, even when I was 24, I'm not going into personal reasons why I particularly wanted to keep out of things, but I never wanted to be part of the mob. I wanted to be complete. I wanted to feel I was independent. It was very important to me, and I didn't particularly want to get involved in this. I can see what happens to directors. As I say, I mean, even Joe was, I felt that was a very tragic business. When I saw Joe just before he died, he came and stayed at my home on his way across to Greenbank, and I thought that was a very tragic experience, because for the first time I heard him talk with any bitterness about the people who were involved and what happened in Australia. It was the very first time, and it came home to me that very forcibly at that time, the terrific effort that he must have made to put on a front.
Yeah.
To appear as if it didn't matter, to appear happy, to give this appearance, as I said, of the childlike simplicity about the whole thing, and the joy.
So,
when John went, though, it was I wasn't going to go back to Australia, because I said to John, I don't want to go back to that mess. And I said, if I come back too, I'd be identified with whatever went on. And I said, I'm in a much more vulnerable position than you are, so I'm going to stay. And we were in a hellish vulnerable position here, because I was not really identified with the research very much, and all I had was a collection of students, and only one of them had really made any significant progress on his thesis. There were five or six papers out of the observatory, and at least three of them weren't really worth considering. I'd say like that 21 centimeter paper really was nothing, it was quite passe.
Mm-hmm. And who was that one student?
There was more than one student, but one was well along. I'd say the one was Alan Moffat. I think Alan is a person, of course, who would need no guidance. I mean, he's that good. He doesn't need any guidance. would have risen to the top regardless of what the circumstances were. The others really hadn't started a thesis and were still scrapping around looking for ideas, you know, at that time.
So it was a bit of a mess, so I became director. When John left.
It was held off for about 6 months, I suppose. I was left, they started the search round and asked big names, and Hanbury Brown was worked on, and people like that, and I sort of advised them on things like that. But, well, it was pretty obvious that no man in his right mind would take over this. Somebody else's idea that was not working, and there was a possibility that we technically overreached ourselves, and it would be very difficult to get somebody to come along without the promise of a very substantial capital investment, which was unlikely to be forthcoming until the thing was operating.
So why wasn't it working?
We had only taken the interferometer had you been used to measure right ascensions. There was no north-south baseline. There had been the only work that had come out of the interferometer.
I guess we skipped ahead.
The 90-foot interferometers. You asked me when John left.
Dishes came on site and so forth.
Right. The first dish was completed in 1958, I think, and the second one was completed in 1959, and there was a big rush. It was early 1959, I think, the whole interferometer went on, and then there was a big rush to sort of get something out. And there were some single dish papers. There was another Centaurus paper, a better one actually. There's a very nice picture of Centaurus, which is often reproduced, although it's outdated now. Barry Clark and John did that, and that was done with the single 90-foot.
Mm-hmm.
There was a few other odd things done with the single 90-foot too. I think that was probably the best piece of work that came out of it. And then the interferometer came on an east-west baseline. And so John worked furiously with a couple of other people, and there were a lot of right ascensions produced. And that was the only work that was really done before John left. Out of that, there were a few identifications. I forget the papers now, but you can easily pick up the papers.
Yeah.
The first of the identifications started coming out of that, and things started looking pretty good. I mean, we were getting, even at that time, a half arc minute.
Identifications helped, aided greatly by being closely associated with the optical people, or?
Yes. I don't think Moffat was that far along at that stage, because there had been some diameter work done east-west looking at things, because I remember one of the last statements that John made, because we had some indication on sources, said, well, it looks like all radio sources are long sticks, which was not a bad guess.
Mm-hmm.
You could see how the next step took place after that, but it was a long time. It was some time, a year, 18 months after that, it was obvious that we had the double source story.
But what was it? What was the tie-in with the optical astronomers? Who were the people that were helping with that?
Well, it wasn't. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but seeing I probably will never write it down, I will. It wasn't the happiest of relationships, quite frankly.
So, did you want to?
Yes, we wanted badly to collaborate, but it was the difficulty in the collaboration, I think, was competition amongst the optical astronomers. I mean, he was a hot subject. I think Guido Munch was one of the few wise ones, and said he said to me one time, he said, "Well," he said, "everybody's cutting each other's throat." He said, "I'm getting out of this game."
I see.
And it was sort of done like reminded me of the French filthy postcard or something like this. You handed out positions one at a time or something like that to the hottest, latest position, and the guy rushed up to the 200-inch telescope and took a photograph.
It sounds suspiciously like molecule line frequencies 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, it was a racket. Sad business, really, and it caused me a lot of trouble, and There was some disruption in the group. I mean, a number of people were involved. As far as the radio astronomers were concerned, I think most of them were pretty much above suspicion. It was the optical astronomers who were sort of scrambling around for the...
So in some way, your nearness here almost worked against you, perhaps?
Well, I think it worked. In the identification game, it worked against us in one. We missed one vital identification, of course. There was the Matthews and Sandage paper, and that was written as the identification of six stellar objects, you know. And the key identification was 3C273, which actually got us a slightly black eye. Now, we were capable of measuring very precise position, but as I said, the people had gotten to this habit of handing out positions one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
If the whole of the position, and I've been putting pressure on, for God's sake, publish the things collectively, put it together and put out the positions, and the optical astronomers were probably more guilty than we were, because they were encouraging this business of one at a time. And some of the people, well, they were looking to their reputations. It was nice to be on. There was a mistake made. It should have been a thing we would have measured easily, you know. The accuracy required wasn't that great, and we were doing quite a lot better. And it was one of the more exciting and interesting stories, and we had a wrong position on it and didn't get the identification. And the identification was done down in Australia, in effect, by the Parkes group.
Right,
who I think communicated with Martin Schmidt, and then Martin Schmidt and Oak worked on it, and then the whole quasi-stellar business blew up, and I remember Sandage coming to me with the paper and saying, well, he said, I've written the paper, it's an honest paper, I don't feel like altering a word in the paper, and therefore what shall we do? I want to add an addendum, and I said, fine, that's all right with me, and then you added the word quasi. Left the title exactly the same. That's how Quasi Stellar came about. So I sort of felt badly about 273, and people said, well, here you are sort of boasting about the positions, the accuracy of positions, and you missed something like that. Or at least maybe I was paranoid, but that was what I sort of felt.
Now, Tom Matthews was here with the radio astronomers.
That's right.
But like you say, the Australian sent the word to Schmidt.
Bolton had formed pretty close relationships with people here, you know, while he was here, so he kept up the communication. And positions have always been John's game, so that was the thing he did when, of course, he's still in it now.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing he got onto when he got back.
But it seemed like this relationship between Matthews and Schmidt worked out for a while anyway.
Yeah, Matthews and Schmidt and Matthews and Sandage, but... it was still done a bit on this. What disturbed me, as I said, was that here we were. There was a number of people who had worked on these positions. By this time, of course, we had declinations as well. Reed had published his stuff, and there was some very nice stuff there. And my God, the name eludes me now. It'll come back in a while still, but Dave Morris. I think Dave Morris's part in this is underestimated, you know. Dave was one of the quietest people and probably the most competent research people that I've ever seen. Dave, you know, would disappear. He was one of these people who would disappear for quite a long time, and he'd come into my office very diffidently and say, I think I might have something here, Gordon. Would you like to look at it? And of course it was all sewn up at that stage. It was spectacular, whatever came in. Anyhow, Dave was largely responsible for working out a lot of the problems in the interferometer, mm-hmm. working out the equations of the interferometer and things like this, and what we had to do. And a lot of the students had worked on it too. And Tom really had the collection of all the positions collectively. So he had a happy relationship with odd astronomers and passing out. I kept on saying, Tom, for Pete's sake, put them all out.
Mm.
But he kept on hanging on to them and hanging on to them and hanging on to them. And if we'd put it out, the regrets, I suppose, are not very important now. This sort of thing would not happen. And actually, after that, I turned Wyndham onto them. And Wyndham did a very fine job. Wyndham and Ed Olson, of course, after that, it took the thing a step further and then started to get uninteresting and become obviously just a plain technical problem. And people at other observatories at that stage started to get on the act, and of course everybody can do positions just as well as we can now.
Yeah.
I mean, we have no special expertise in that area whatsoever. But Dave Morris deserves a lot of credit. John Wyndham, who inherited a very difficult position, and he still had this problem, you know, a very temperamental optical astronomer. The Frenchman Baron, and he sort of had a difficult problem. They were both difficult people, and there was a lot of discussion about who got priority for what. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, during the early 60s, there were a number of students who later turned out to be quite excellent radio astronomers. What do you attribute this to, or do you have any ideas of how this came about?
Yes. I think so. In fact, I talked to Jesse, sort of buttonholed me the other day, and said, well, he said the strength of the observatory was in the students in the early days, and why don't we get more students or something like that? Well, I felt, I said when John left, I felt very much alone. I had, there was myself who had some background, but my background is largely engineering. Concepts of instruments and things like this, and I didn't particularly want to get deeply into the